decision, and we will get that information to you from our general counsel here as soon as we can get any information and figure out what's going on with that court decision. I appreciate all of you coming this morning. My name is Carol Tobias. I am the president of the National Right to Life Committee, and I would like to just briefly introduce our head table. To my left is Olivia Gans Turner, the president of the Virginia Society for Human Life. So, and even though we've been advertising the convention as being in Washington, D.C., we actually are in Virginia. So, president of the Virginia Society for Human Life. Our guest speaker this morning, Stephen Mosier, and I will introduce him a little bit later. And then to my right is the Honorable Jolene Williams, Chairman of the Board of Directors of National Right to Life, a longtime resident of Richmond, Virginia, the former mayor of Virginia, and we are just very happy to have her with us this morning. I want to thank you all for coming this morning, actually to the entire convention, and I'm going to take a personal time out here and just introduce my husband, Damon Tobias. He's the he is the love of my life and the person who gives me the encouragement and the motivation to keep going. He's also my chauffeur taking me back and forth to the airport. And as long as he comes to pick me up, I'm okay. I would like to welcome you all to the 42nd Annual National Right to Life Convention. We have a fantastic convention lined up for you. This morning we get to hear from Stephen Mosier. This afternoon, Lila Rose. Later this evening, Congressman Chris Smith, Majority Leader Eric Cantor, Reggie Littlejohn. Tomorrow we'll have Congressman Trent Franks, Senator Kelly Ayotte. We're going to hear from Monsignor James Lasante and Governor Sam Brownback. We've just got a fantastic all-star lineup for our general sessions and our meals. But in between, we have workshops on just about every topic you can imagine. Webcam abortions, using social media to advance the cause of life, Planned Parenthood, abortion on the international scene, working with legislators, fundraising, the legal stuff with the IRS and the FEC, assisted suicide, working with your churches, denial of life-saving medical treatment. I think we've got a little bit of something for everyone. So I hope you really take advantage of all the different workshops and the speakers and the experts that are here to learn and to motivate yourself. We all have a lot of love for life and a respect for the dignity and the sanctity of every human life. There are no strangers in this room. So please take some time to visit with each other during the convention. Learn how maybe something that you're doing could be done more effectively, or if you've got some success stories in your chapter or your state area, I would encourage you to share those with others so that they can also be encouraged. This really is the premier gathering of Right to Lifers from all over the country. We have people here from our state affiliates and those who work with our 3,000 chapters, and we are extremely happy that you have joined us this week. Also here are people who work with crisis pregnancy centers or pregnancy resource centers, offering the direct aid to women who are in that situation where they're trying to make a life or death decision for their child. We are glad that you are here. We have women in this audience who have had abortions. We've got women in the movement who have had abortions, and they have become very eloquent spokespersons for the pro-life movement working with us to protect unborn children. And I wouldn't be surprised with the number of women in this country who have had abortions, if there are some at this convention, maybe in this room, who've had an abortion and you haven't had the ability, or I don't want to say the courage, but you have not yet been able to talk to anyone or tell anyone about that abortion. You are among friends, and we welcome you here. We're glad that you are here. And we are also thrilled. We are also thrilled at the number of young people that are at the convention. I'm going to address that just a little bit later. But thanks to your hard work in the 2010 elections, 2011 and 2012 have been record-breaking years for the pro-life movement in passing legislation in state after state. Following up on Nebraska's groundbreaking passage of the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, before the 2010 elections, six more states have passed this legislation protecting unborn children who are capable of feeling pain. We have passed state legislation requiring the abortionist to provide specific information to the woman who is seeking an abortion. Some of these laws even require the abortionist to perform an ultrasound so that the woman can see the picture of her unborn child prior to the abortion. Some states have passed a law prohibiting the use of webcams so that an abortionist cannot prescribe chemical drugs to a woman via computer in another city or maybe even in another state. States have passed laws to opt out of abortion provisions that have been coming through Obamacare. What was even more fun was seeing states like North Carolina and New Hampshire override vetoes of pro-life legislation that came from their governor. And just as importantly, states like Vermont and Hawaii have been able to hold off, so far, assisted suicide. But I know that that battle is going to continue in those states, and they would appreciate your prayers for their efforts. And as long as you're praying, then add Massachusetts, because they are facing an assisted suicide referendum this fall. There were many pro-life victories in the state legislatures. Elections do matter. And we have another opportunity to make a difference in about 4 months. Now, earlier this year, we saw the big blow up when Susan G. Komen, Race for the Cure, announced that they were not going to give funding or provide funding to Planned Parenthood. Apparently, Komen was under the mistaken impression that Planned Parenthood was doing mammograms. So when Komen announced that they were not going to provide this funding anymore, there was an unbelievable uproar in the media. And Planned Parenthood, of course, was pushing this. They did not want to take the publicity hit, because if one donor was able to back out, other donors might start backing out as well. And Planned Parenthood wants to put themselves out as a respectable organization. Unfortunately, Komen was bullied into reversing their position. Now, MSNBC and the National Public Radio have both recently done stories on the annual Komen races for the cure that they do all over the country. And both of them reported that the race participants have dropped anywhere from 30 to 50% all over the country. Now, MSNBC and National Public Radio are not exactly known for their conservative bent, so we shouldn't be surprised that they were attributing the decline in people participating to the fact that Planned Parenthood supporters were upset with Komen for not giving the money to Planned Parenthood, or at least for trying to take it away, so that they were no longer participating. But the money has not stopped flowing. If you support Planned Parenthood, why would you then stop supporting the Komen race for the G. Komen race for the cure? I think it's the other side of the coin. Because of all the publicity and the media that was generated by this whole issue, a lot of eyes were opened. People in this country now know that Susan G. Komen, Race for the Cure, is giving money to Planned Parenthood. And the people who genuinely wanted to support breast cancer research are finding other organizations to give their money to, not the largest abortion provider in the nation. That flare-up over Komen and Planned Parenthood was soon followed by the mandate from the Obama administration forcing religious institutions to provide services through their health insurance plans that they had a moral objection to. Then came the big controversy over Virginia's legislation to require that an abortionist perform an ultrasound before the abortion. And pretty soon, everywhere around the country, we were hearing about the war on women. Actually, our opponents had been talking about it for several months before that, but this spring is really when it got that traction. The so-called war on women, as you all know, is a big myth. If you think abortion should be restricted in any way, then you are engaging in a war on women. This was nothing but a political, pathetic ploy by the president and his allies to help to reinsure his re-election, which... Well, we're going to talk about that tomorrow at the PAC rally. This isn't a PAC event. FEC, IRS. Next January, America will recognize the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton. While some in this country will be celebrating a so-called right for women, we are going to be mourning the loss of 55 million unborn children who have lost their lives in this Holocaust. After 40 years, it's understandable some pro-lifers are getting a little tired, and they're kind of wondering, you know, is everything we're doing working? When is this battle going to be over? I would like to share with you one of my favorite Bible verses, Galatians 6:9. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Let's look to William Wilberforce, that great member of Parliament over in Great Britain, who was the leader of the abolition movement for slavery. He introduced his first bill into the British Parliament in 1788 in opposition to slave trading in the British Empire. 20 years later, in 1807, Parliament finally stopped the slave trade. But slavery itself was still legal. It took another 26 years to abolish slavery altogether. Now, we are certainly glad that William Wilberforce and his allies didn't give up, and neither are we going to give up. And we do have much to be optimistic about. I truly believe the country is turning, the people are coming our direction. A Gallup poll released last month found that 50% of Americans identified themselves as pro-life, and this after years of being told that the pro-lifers are mean and evil and we don't care about women. 50% of the people were still saying, I'm pro-life. They put that tag on themselves, compared to 41% who said that they were pro-choice. Now, according to Gallup, that 41% figure is the lowest percentage that people who identify as pro-choice have ever had since they've been doing the poll in 1995. So 50 to 41, that would sound like the country is still fairly evenly divided. But if you look a little more closely at the details, 38% of the people said that abortion should be legal in all cases or in most cases. 59% said abortion should never be allowed, or it should be allowed only in a few cases. And this is the Gallup summary. Overall, Americans' views on abortions have shifted slightly over the past several years, so that some groups who tended to be pro-choice from 2001 to 2008 are now more evenly divided in their views. And others who were closely divided in their views from 2001 to 2008 now clearly tilt pro-life. Our efforts to change hearts and minds are working. And another reason to be extremely optimistic is right here in this hotel with us, our youth, our young people. While we gather here, the National Teens for Life Convention is also going on. Young people from around the country are eager to learn how they can be more effective in influencing their peers, their fellow students, their neighbors, their friends. Also here this week are students who are participating in the National Right to Life Oratory Contest. Again, young people from around the country participating in contests trying to see who can come to the National Right to Life Convention to give their speech, to be the national winner, to talk about pro-life issues. National Right to Life has a program bringing in interns every summer, and we've got several of those this year. They are here at the convention, and they're going to be working. This is not a vacation for them. So they're going to be here to help to make sure the convention goes smoothly. We also have former and current students of the National Right to Life Academy. For 5 weeks this summer, we've got students who are going to be learning the pro-life issues. They're going to learn the history of the movement. They're going to learn in depth how to talk about embryonic stem cell research and denial of life-saving medical care and abortion. And, you know, it's a school on pro-life issues. But they're also going to learn how to use that knowledge, because they will have to give speeches on the topics that they have learned about. And they will have to learn how to lobby elected officials. Someone's going to pretend to be a member of Congress, and they have to lobby. And believe me, they get put through the ringer on this. They have to learn how to do media interviews. We want to train the young people so that they are ready to go out into the world working with our chapters and our affiliates to really make a difference. please take some time in the next couple of days when you see the young people wandering around to give them some encouragement, to thank them for being here, and to just really motivate them and encourage them. It's not that they are the future of the movement, because they are part of the movement right now. They are making a difference in their schools and in their communities. Nancy Keenan, the president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, is stepping down from her position at the end of the year. And one of the reasons... Yeah. That's not as important as the reason, one of the reasons she gave for stepping down. She said that the passion that the young people on the pro-life side have is so much more intense than the young people in her movement. She recognized that pro-life young people in this country are passionate about saving babies, about defending the disabled and the elderly. And she knows that they can't match it. And she has acknowledged maybe they need a younger face to be able to, you know, motivate them. And I don't think that's going to make a difference. Because quite frankly, it's easier to defend life than to try to end it. Now, Nancy has said that she's not going to step down until the end of the year because her one last goal as she leaves office is to re-elect President Obama. Now, I've met Nancy only once, and she may be a nice lady, but I have no trouble hoping that she leaves her term in office very disappointed. Yeah. We have much to be excited about. The movement is marching forward. We're changing hearts and minds, but we do have a lot of work to do. So I'm very glad that you are all here. We've got in the next 3 days that we can learn, we can educate each other, we can motivate and encourage each other for that task ahead. I have no doubt that we are going to do well this week, this year, and we're going to come back together again next year with some big smiles on our faces and doing a happy dance. At this time, I would like to bring forward Olivia Gans Turner, the president of the Virginia Society for Human Life.
Carol can be forgiven for that little slip. I'm actually a newlywed of only 2 months, so the entire pro-life movement is getting used to the new name. I understand that. To be honest, I have to get used to it, too. I tried to check in here at the hotel the other day and actually used my maiden name. But I am somebody else now, and unfortunately, my beloved husband is not with me. He's a working man, so he's off at his job today and will join us this evening. But he wished me well this morning as he kissed me out the door, and he said, "Go get him, girl." And that's what I'm telling all of you, is go get him. This is the year... so often we hear this in the movement, but this is the year that I believe defines what the course of our nation will be in the next 4, 8, 10, 20, 30 years. We've seen what can happen when someone who doesn't respect life is given the authority that our current president has. We understand in our individual states what can happen when pro-abortion forces can manipulate and define the conversation. Our own state of Virginia, the great Commonwealth of Virginia, which is proud to be the host state again of the National Right to Life Committee's convention, underwent a firestorm this year. And many of you heard about it across the country. Weeks after our state worked to pass a protective and reasonable ultrasound law that would give women the opportunity to see their unborn children before the abortion occurs, that would require unscrupulous abortionists to perform what is simple good medicine, was fought at and shot at, and potatoes and tomatoes and shouting matches were formed all over Virginia to defeat this reasonable legislation. You all heard about that. It made the national news. We were the subject of The Daily Show. We were jokes on the evening talk shows. The Commonwealth of Virginia doing something rational and reasonable. The pro-life movement in Virginia attempting to do something that makes sense when a woman is about to make a life and death decision about her unborn child became the butt of jokes and foolishness. And I know we were a part of a plan to redefine what the conversation was about. But I also know, after my years in the movement, that it's we in the movement that define the conversation. We tell the media what is the issue. And the issue is always life hanging in the balance. One innocent life at a time being saved by the protective laws that we pass, whether it's an unborn child in her mother's womb, whether it's a disabled person concerned about what's going to happen when healthcare rationing comes into play, whether it's a dependent elderly person unsure of whether or not our society still respects and sees their value simply based on their age. All of these individual lives are our constituents. They depend on us to be their face. We come to this event year in and year out. Some of you are new here. Some of you, I see old friends, I see new friends, I see fellow Virginians, I see people I've met across the country, and I understand with all my heart that when you come to this event, you come to learn, to be encouraged, and to become ready for the task ahead. There is a task. You are the ones who have to go get them. You are the only ones who will have that power and opportunity in the next few months to capture the imagination of the culture that you live in, the communities you come from, the churches that you attend, to educate, to compassionately respond to the need, and to lead, most of all, to lead. To have the courage to stand when no one else will and speak truth to lies. I said in my welcoming letter to all of you in the convention book that this is a family reunion of sorts. And as I just said, I see old friends and I'm meeting new friends. Even this morning, I've met two or three new acquaintances who will suddenly now be my long-lost cousins, my friends and family from far away and near, because that's what the movement is. We are the family of those who have been forgotten. We are the family of those who cannot speak for themselves. We are the voice that must be heard when the din is so loud that it becomes overwhelming to try to speak. That's what happened in Virginia this year, and unfortunately, it spilled over into your states. 2 weeks after my wedding, I went to the state of Michigan while sitting in a relatively a pleasant little town, but I have to confess, Barb, it is a small town, Ludington, Michigan. It's not a big place. I'm sitting in a small town, and the reporter at the table asks me, "So what happened in Virginia? What went wrong down there? What'd you guys try to do to women?" So in a small town, far from my home base, the damage was done. But because we in Virginia and elsewhere, the National Right to Life Office, continue to tell the truth that ultrasounds are reasonable, good medicine for women, that women want to see their children, that abortionists will deny women this information unless required by law to do it, the more we said it, guess what? The media has already started to change what they're able to actually say on that particular question. They started in Virginia by saying that women were being raped by instruments, and we responded in Virginia by saying, no, it is the abortion procedure itself that is nothing more and nothing less than a deadly rape that takes her child and leaves her maimed emotionally and physically for the rest of her life. That's the true damage to be done. And the more we said it, the more they couldn't say that this procedure that is done by way of ultrasound in early pregnancy, which is done over 98% of the time, was not standard practice. They couldn't say that anymore. They couldn't say that this was not the norm and not reasonable because we told the truth. And they checked on it. And sure enough, doctors verified that this particular type of ultrasound was done 98% of the time or more. So guess what? The lie they crafted fizzled. it fell off the vine before it could take hold. Now, they're still going to say there's a war on women, and they're still going to say that it's pro-life laws like the ones that the National Right to Life State Development, a state legislation office and federal legislation office works to pass. They're going to say all of those attacks are attacks on women, attacks on our rights. And what we're going to say is that the mothers and fathers of aborted children know better. And it's not just the women in this room who've been through the abortions. It's not the fathers as well who are here who have been the fathers of aborted children. It's all of you who, not just emotionally and psychologically, but actually physically are related to us. Everybody in here is somebody's mother, father, best friend, cousin, aunt, uncle, sister, brother of someone who's had an abortion. Our culture has reaped the whirlwind of what we have allowed to happen. But the fact that we come every year to gather, to learn, to become encouraged, to be educated, and prepared to lead, indicates what I think is the true American spirit. I love being a Virginian now. I'm a native Californian, but I love being a Virginian because we are the cradle of liberty. We are where all these ideas came forward and where true Americanism was really born in our eyes, at least as far as Virginians are concerned. I'm sure Jalene would agree with that. Yes. Yes, I thought so. I have to confer with Jalene because she is Virginia, basically, folks. She is Virginia. So, but this is where American thought became American possibility. And we don't give up, and we don't say die, and we don't lie down when lies are told. So this is our beginning point this week. We have months ahead to work, to pray, to teach, to guide, and to win, whether it's winning our legislative activities or our elections. With a smile on our face, with a hopeful spirit that never believes in failure, but believes in constantly picking ourselves up, trying it a new way, getting it right the next time if we didn't get it right the first time, we will succeed. And as Carol finished with one of her favorite Bible verses, I will finish with mine, one of mine that is absolutely, I think, dear to the movement's, should be dear to the movement's heart, and that is Jeremiah 29. Fear not, for I know the plans I have for your future, plans for you to prosper and not to fail. That's our motto. We will prosper. We will save lives. We are a family. We are united in the cause of life, and we are true to the end. Welcome to Virginia. Have a wonderful time. Come say hi at our booth. If you're a Virginian, please stop by the VSHL booth, and God bless you all this weekend.
Thank you, Olivia. We would all now like to call on Jalene Williams, Chairman of the Board of Directors of the National Right to Life Committee. Jalene.
Thank you, Carol, and good morning, everybody. I want to call to your attention that the 1960s were a time of turmoil. There was the Vietnam War. There was mayhem on college campuses across the country where authority was defied, where tearing up the grounds and occupying the president's office was the usual thing. There was no right or no wrong. Lola gets what Lola wants. Assassinations in the 1960s of our president, John F. Kennedy, and of Martin Luther King. All of this happened in the 1960s. And amidst this cauldron of unrest and radical change, the bandwagon for liberation of abortion laws rolled across the country. The liberation, the goal was to liberate the abortion law in every state. In those days, states, all of them, had laws against abortion. Some of them permitting abortion to save the life of the mother. In 1967, the Virginia Society of Human Life was formed. There were a handful of us. It was very hard to bring people together to support the law as it was to protect the law, because this movement was so much a shock and a surprise. There was no organization at the grassroots level to protect the law. So a few of us in Virginia got together and formed the Virginia Society for Human Life in 1967. And our purpose was to protect Virginia's law. Virginia's law, like others, permitted, like many others, permitted abortion only to save the life of the mother. And abortion was anathema. No one spoke of abortion. You never alluded to it. It was such a terrible thing. And this was society's feeling about abortion. And so law was rarely, the Virginia's law against abortion was rarely challenged because it was supported. And however, in a Supreme Court case in 1949, Miller versus Bennett, the Supreme Court of Virginia ruled in support of Virginia's abortion law, and it stated the purpose of Virginia's abortion law, which was, quote, the protection of the life of the unborn child, and through it, society. So we are here today in Virginia, where the first state pro-life organization was formed, to move that. Now we are rolling across the country, as was described in Carol's comments this morning. And we are moving in the right direction, and we are going to continue to move. We're not giving up. And what you are doing by being here at the convention is fueling the forward advancement of the pro-life movement. Good luck, and I hope you enjoy the convention, and welcome to Virginia.
Thank you very much, Jolene. Now, the real reason that you're all here this morning, I'd like to introduce our guest speaker, Stephen Mosher, is an internationally recognized authority on China and population issues, as well as an acclaimed author and speaker. He has worked tirelessly since 1979 to fight coercive population control programs, and has helped hundreds of thousands of women and families worldwide over the years. In 1979, Stephen was the first American social scientist to visit mainland China. He was invited there by the Chinese government, where he had access to government documents and actually witnessed women being forced to have abortions under their new one-child policy. Mr. Mosher was a pro-choice atheist at the time, but witnessing these traumatic abortions led him to reconsider his convictions and to eventually become a practicing pro-life Roman Catholic. Mr. Mosher has appeared numerous times before Congress as an expert in world population, China, and human rights abuses. He has also made television appearances on Good Morning America, 60 Minutes, The Today Show, 2020, and on Fox and CNN news shows, as well as being a regular guest on talk radio shows across the nation. Stephen is also an author of the best-selling book, A Mother's Ordeal, One Woman's Fight Against China's One-Child Policy. He lives in Virginia with his wife, Vera, and their 9 children. Please welcome Mr. Stephen Mosher.
Well, good morning, everyone. If you're like me, you're probably more interested in reading the Supreme Court decision this morning than listening to Stephen Mosher, but I will do my best to distract you for a short time while we parse this decision about Obamacare, this unconstitutional attack on the unborn and the elderly, and continue working to consign it to the dustbin of history. Now, as my primary principal distraction for you this morning, I have a series of short videos. Now, my goal is to convince you, if any of you still need convincing, that there's no overpopulation problem on planet Earth. In fact, I want to convince you that overpopulation and you should hear the quotes that I put around that phrase, is a myth. And it's important to understand going into this discussion that this myth is not just a harmless fantasy. This myth is rather a deadly deceit that has been used to justify the killing of hundreds and hundreds of millions of unborn children worldwide, 400 million in China alone. It continues today, this myth of overpopulation does, to be used to justify the legalization of abortion, the promotion of abortion, and the performance of massive numbers of abortions in country after country around the globe. Believers in this deadly myth often equate the birth of a baby with some injury to the planet. The birth of a baby means the death of a whale or the death of a tree. And believing this, many of them are prepared to kill that baby to save that tree or that whale. But I want to tell you today that this is a myth, and start by talking about the origins of this myth of overpopulation. We'll start, Louise, with the first video, which is called Overpopulation: The Making of a Myth. These are only about a minute and a half long. They're available on YouTube. They've got now over 1.5 million views.
The myth of overpopulation originated in England in 1798, when a vicar named Thomas Malthus, who fancied himself something of a mathematician, saw that food production increased incrementally, but people reproduced exponentially. He sat down and did some simple math, and summarily decided that the world would be out of food by 1890. He blamed reduced mortality rates, and recommended killing off the have-nots of society, lest the haves starve to death. This cry was taken up by Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University in 1968, who claimed that reckless human reproduction had overwhelmed the Earth. Massive famines would result, which would destroy, best-case scenario, 1/5 of humanity by the end of the 70s, and the planet would follow. This fear produced large donations for the newly created UNFPA, which thrives on an imagined crisis that has been both imminent and rescheduled again and again over the past 2 centuries. The truth of the matter is that every family on this planet could have a house with a yard and all live together on a landmass the size of Texas, which is really just a small corner of the planet. The population of Earth will peak in 30 years and then start to go back down. We're not overpopulated. Do the math.
So, thank you. So we get this myth originally from the Reverend Thomas Malthus, who kind of gets a pass because he was an Anglican minister. But what you have to understand is that Reverend Malthus was actually an economist who for 20 years worked for the British East India Company. Now, the British East India Company had for 100 years the charter to run India after India was conquered by the British Army. The Crown of England gave a special charter to the British East India Company to make a profit off India. And they did by exporting the best of what India had to England or reselling it overseas. Now, the Malthusian message was this, that population growth will always exceed food supply over time, because population grows geometrically and food production, he said, can only grow arithmetically at a slower rate. The message was sweet to the ears of the directors of the British East India Company because what it meant to them was there was no point in responding to famines in India, which would periodically take the lives of millions of Indians in places in the north and south of India. There's no point in responding to those famines because the Indians were simply having too many children, and if you averted a famine this year by allowing them to eat the grain and the pork that they themselves had grown instead of exporting it overseas, you would simply be setting up the situation for a larger and worse famine that would take even more lives a generation in the future. So the myth of overpopulation, the Malthusian origins of it, became a justification for a hands-off policy towards India and other British colonies, where when famine occurred, people were just left to die. So the Reverend Malthus, instead of responding to his better angels and responding to the needs of those who were hungry by providing them with food, said, no, don't provide them with food. Let them die, because if they don't, they and their children will die inevitably in the future. We also see the Malthusian myth of overpopulation at play in the Irish potato famine. I have cases in my ancestry who came to the United States rather than starve to death in Ireland. But the same view held sway in Great Britain in the 1850s. The view that the Irish were simply having too many children and that their population would inevitably exceed the food supply in Ireland, and that if you tried to avert the Irish potato famine and saved 1 million lives this year, in 20 years you'd have another even worse famine that would take 4 or 5 million lives in the future. And so again, the myth of overpopulation has been used to justify not just abortion, but terrible inhumanity of man to man. And of course, we've seen that the fundamental premise of the myth is mistaken. We've seen food supply continue to increase faster than population for decades now because of the Green Revolution. We've seen per capita food consumption continue to go up worldwide, even though we have 7 billion people, we're eating better than ever before. And yet people still talk about overpopulation and still talk about the fact that soon we will run out of food. Lewis, let's go to the next YouTube video.
According to believers in overpopulation, there are so many of us on the planet that food production cannot possibly keep up. However, according to both the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization and the World Food Program, there is currently enough food on the planet for everyone to be well fed. Not only that, but we're growing this food on less land than we did in the past. This is why in the United States, for example, the government can afford to pay farmers not to grow food, but instead return their farmland to the wild. Modern technology also allows us to grow food on land where it would have been impossible to do so, even a few years ago. Agricultural experts even believe that Africa, if cultivated using modern farming methods, could eventually feed the whole world, all by itself. Then why are people in many parts of the world starving? The World Food Program lists key causes of hunger, and overpopulation is not on that list. War, one of the leading causes of world hunger, destroys crops and disrupts relief efforts. Widespread poverty prevents many from buying the food that they need. And a lack of infrastructure means that there isn't a reliable way to transport food to areas that need it. This is why reducing the number of hungry people will not make the remaining people less hungry. Those who have access to the food will continue to have access to it, and those who don't will still be hungry. Reducing population will not magically cause food to be spread around equally. And blaming overpopulation for everything does nothing but distract us from the real problems that we actually have. Think about it. Yeah.
So let me tell you about the worst famine in human history. This was a famine not caused by too many babies. It is not caused by overpopulation. It was caused by government mismanagement of the economy. It happened in China from 1960 to 1962. A couple of years before, in 1958, Chairman Mao Zedong forced the Chinese people into large communes. Up to 80,000 people were told that they were to farm the land in common. Communist Party officials were put in charge of these so-called people's communes. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't plant on time, they didn't irrigate properly, they didn't harvest on time, crops were lost, and by 1960, there was a nationwide famine, and millions of people were starting to die. Now, at that point, Chairman Mao could have done the right thing. He could have announced to the world that his policies had failed and asked for help, and the great grain-producing countries of the world, like the United States and Canada, and Australia would have responded generously, and ships of grain would have begun arriving in Chinese ports. Instead, he tried to hide the famine, hide the evidence of his failure, and he did the worst possible thing. He sent the People's Liberation Army, the Red Army, out into the countryside to collect the last stores of grain from starving peasants. He wanted to make sure the army was well fed, because if you're a dictator and the people with the guns get too unhappy with you, you often have a short and unhappy life. He wanted to make sure the workers in the cities didn't starve to death in large numbers, but he didn't care about the peasants. And 43 million people died from 1960 to 1962, not because of something called overpopulation, not because they were having too many children, but because the megalomaniac who was running China, who had no concern for human life, blamed his mistakes on the Chinese people, and they died by the tens of millions. Nothing to do with overpopulation. Now, the population controllers, in addition to telling us that we're running out of food, which is not true, also tell us that you can eliminate poverty by eliminating the poor and their children. But is this true? Let's watch the next video. And we need sound.
And we face. When human beings first showed up on this planet, there weren't very many of us. And we faced a hard life of meeting our basic needs. Chances are, early humans spent a good deal of time hungry, cold, and without shelter. That is to say, poor. According to the World Bank, poverty is when people are deprived of well-being as a result of low income and aren't able to get the basic goods that they need for survival with dignity. How did any of the human race advance beyond poverty? We kept multiplying and we formed communities. In communities, people stop spending all their time on simple survival and are able to do things like divide up tasks, share resources, and pool their mental energies to come up with creative solutions to problems. These communities started with families, then grew into extended families, entire tribes, and then finally cities and nations. So what effect has this growth had on poverty? According to demographers, a very good one. In fact, history shows that as our numbers have grown, so has our average standard of living. Scientists measure this standard in everything from per capita income to average amount of calories consumed, even average height. And all of these averages have been increasing. Even though poverty still exists, the percentage of poor people has actually decreased as population has grown. The reason for this is that human beings are not simply consumers, we are producers. This is why, over the ages, we have learned how to do things like produce more food on less land, find better energy sources, and make sure that more people have enough to eat and a roof over their heads. And this is also why, though urban poverty is still a huge problem, statistics show that the poor who move to large communities actually have better chances of rising from poverty than they did in areas where there were fewer jobs and less opportunity. For this reason, poverty is a problem that is not solved by eliminating people. Poverty has always been a problem, even when there were scarcely any people on the entire planet. People are the only proven way out of poverty. Removing them will only leave the poor right where they started. Think about it.
So people are the ultimate resource, the one resource you cannot do without. We need children. Children are the only future that a family has, the only future that a country has. A baby at birth in the United States will produce much more on average than he or she will consume over his or her lifetime. If you crunch the numbers that we have, every baby born in the United States will contribute about $500,000 more to the economy than they will consume. So every baby, the birth of every baby is the birth of a small fortune. The death of every baby by abortion is the death of a small fortune. It makes us all poor in a moral sense, of course, but it makes us all poor economically as well. Those on the other side of this issue need to understand this argument, that a baby is the ultimate resource, and that an abortion clinic is something like a Mercedes-Benz factory that instead of producing new Mercedes-Benzes, takes Mercedes-Benzes and turns them into junk. You're killing off the most valuable resource that we have. Every stomach comes with two hands attached. Every mouth is backed by a creative intelligence, which, if properly educated, will make life better for not just themselves, but for their families and for their nation as well. Now, we've heard a lot over the years about zero population growth. But country after country is actually falling below the 2.1 children needed to maintain a stable population, as the next video shows.
For From the time of the cavemen all the way until today, humanity continues to exist because each generation of people has produced another generation to replace itself. Scientists have figured out how many people need to be born each generation to replace the generation before. That number is one person per person. All things being equal, this creates perfect demographic balance. Since women are the only ones who can have children, replacing every person on Earth means each woman needs to have two children. One to replace her, and the other to replace the man, who cannot have children. The total fertility rate is the average number of children each woman in a society is having. This number shows us if a society is growing or shrinking. In developed countries, the replacement rate birth rate is 2.1 children per woman. This will keep the population stable, but even that is assuming that every woman has children, and that there are no wars, famines, or disease. In the real world, disasters happen all the time, and sadly, not all children reach adulthood, especially in poor countries. This pushes their replacement rate up to 3.3 children per woman. Since not every woman wants to have children, in order to keep the population stable, some women need to have more than 2.1 children to balance the birth rate with the women who are only having one, or no children at all. Maintaining this balance is of the utmost importance. If society does not at least replace itself every generation, human numbers begin to fall exponentially. Economic and social problems appear, as elderly people retiring begin to outnumber young people entering the workplace. This is already happening all over the developed world. Many of the world's nations are only barely replacing themselves, while a growing majority have birth rates below replacement, some as low as 1.8 or even 1.2 babies per woman. Many societies are facing a very real danger. Extinction.
So every developed country is dying. Every country that has a high standard of living is having too few children to replace the current population. And the great irony is that these dying countries, led by the United States and by the UN Population Fund, are spending billions of dollars to force the birth rate down in less developed countries where they have birth rates that are still above replacement. And this doesn't make any sense either, because we go into a place like Kenya and we say that you Kenyans should be averaging two children per family. You should have a national population policy. We'll fund it. We'll stock your hospitals with abortion equipment. We will fund population control programs. When in fact, death rates, mortality rates among children and infants in Kenya is still high, and they have to have three or four children in order to have two children survive to adulthood. And what I told Bill Gates 10 years ago was, look, if you're worried that the birth rates in Latin America and Asia and Africa are too high, what you should be doing is providing primary health care, malaria tablets for malaria victims, penicillin for people with pneumonia, inoculations to prevent people from dying from preventable tropical diseases. Because if you do that, if you lower the infant and child mortality rate, the birth rate will fall in consequence. This is well known. This is called the demographic transition. Child mortality rates fall, and then birth rates fall in consequence. Don't go out and force population control programs on countries where they don't have clean drinking water. Don't give the radical feminists hundreds of millions of dollars so they can promote abortion in poor countries where women actually want antibiotics for sick kids and not so-called reproductive health care. Respond, I said, to the better angels of your nature. Do the right thing and help children live. And this other problem, this so-called problem of overpopulation that you're so worried about, will solve itself. The last video is about 7 billion people. Last year, we passed the 7 billion mark, and the doomsayers came out of the woodwork. But this milestone is not something to bemoan. It's something to celebrate. And we're going now to the last video, Louise. Video number 5. It's called 7 Billion People. It's
the last. From the time of the cavemen all the way until today, humanity continues to exist because each generation.
Okay. Here we are. We can relax now.
At some point in the year 2011, the Earth will hold 7 billion people on its surface, more people than any point in recorded history. While some welcome this latest member of humanity with excitement, others with fear. When people hear that we've been adding 1 billion people every 15 years, they imagine humanity's growth to look something like this. But 1 billion people isn't as high a percentage of humanity as it used to be. For instance, imagine this roller coaster car represents 1 billion people. If we add another car, or 1 billion more people, our train has doubled in length. But if we want to double the train again, we can't just add one more train car. We'd have to add two. Every time we make the train longer, one train car represents a smaller and smaller percentage of the train. If it takes 15 years to add each new train car, then mathematically speaking, the growth rate is slowing. In order for the growth rate to stay constant, the train would have to keep doubling every 15 years, instead of just adding one car. Human population growth is the same way. In 1804, the world's population hit 1 billion. By 1927, that number had doubled. But by 1960, that number had only grown by half. By 1975, it was only growing by a third, and then a fourth, and then a fifth. To see how population growth is slowing down, we look at a number called the global total fertility rate, which is the average number of children each woman is having. And over the last 40 years, that rate has been rapidly falling. According to the UN's current data, the world's population is due to peak in 25 years. After it peaks, it will start to go down. By the end of the century, we'll be losing 1 billion people every 20 years. This year, the world's population will hit 7 billion. In 75 years, we'll be back here again. Think about it.
From 1960 to 2000, the world's population doubled. We went from 3 billion to 6 billion. And my former colleague at Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb. And other people helped to set up the UN Population Fund in response to this so-called crisis, this so-called problem of overpopulation. What they fail to understand, but what we need to know, is that the reason the world's population doubled is not because people started breeding like rabbits, but because they stopped dying like flies. Mortality rates were going down throughout this whole period. Lifespans were lengthening. At the end of World War II, the average person on the planet lived into their late 30s. Right now, the average lifespan on the planet is almost 70 years of age. We have nearly doubled human lifespans in the last half century. And naturally, if people are living almost twice as long, there are going to be twice as many of us around at any given time. This is not something we should don sackcloth and ashes over. This is not something we should bemoan. This is something we should celebrate. This is a victory over death. Now, you would think that these numbers, that these videos would speak for themselves. But the mainstream media on this issue seems more inclined to propagate false myths than report the truth, or even allow rigorous debate. Let me give you an example. Here is how the media shuts us out in many cases. The BBC called me on Tuesday of this week to ask if I would go on air to discuss a report out of China on the one-child policy. Abuses in the one-child policy abound. We haven't time to talk about them today, but forced abortions are still occurring. Forced sterilizations, late-term abortions of the kind that I witnessed over 30 years ago are still happening every day in China. Women are being arrested for the crime of being pregnant, the crime of being pregnant, taken sometimes by force to abortion clinics, sometimes held down on operating tables and forced to have abortions. Babies are being killed at birth because they're illegal children. They don't have a quota from the government, the quota that would allow them to live, and without that quota, they're condemned to death. So all of these things are still happening. The BBC wanted me on the air. I had a lengthy pre-interview interview with Rosita Rizzotti of the BBC, eager to have me on. Then shortly before I was to go on, I received the following email. Steve, how best do we describe the Population Research Institute? We may have a problem if it is a pro-life organization. I welcome your advice, please. Regards, Rose. Well, I confirmed that, yes, we were a pro-life organization, but we were also engaged in objective demographic and population research. But the segment was canceled. Why? Because we're pro-life, and therefore we're beyond the pale of what the BBC considers to be the allowable range of opinions on subjects. And so we don't exist, and the listeners of the BBC are not allowed to hear us. So the deadly myth of overpopulation that continues to kill millions, tens of millions of babies each year in China and elsewhere lives on. The good news, of course, is that we now have alternative media. We have YouTube, like the videos that we showed, which have closing in on a couple million views. We have email, we have Facebook, we have Twitter. So who needs the dinosaurs at the BBC? And of course, with email, with Facebook, with Twitter, we also have the future. We in the pro-life movement own the future. Let me close with a story from the Canadian March for Life. It took a while for things to get going up in Canada. They didn't start their March for Life until 1997. But this year, I was up there for the march, spoke at the march. They had 20,000 people in front of the Canadian Parliament building, which was a new record for them. Last year, I think they had 13,000 people. So the numbers are growing in Canada and here and elsewhere in the world. Now, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police partitioned the area in front of the Canadian Parliament building, a huge lawn, into two areas, one for the pro-life demonstrators and one for the pro-abortion demonstrators. They gave, we pro-lifers, about two-thirds of the lawn. They gave the pro-abortion demonstrators about one-third of the lawn. Now, let's talk about the numbers. We had 20,000 on our two-thirds of the lawn. In fact, our 20,000 went out into the street and down the street because we could have used some of the one-third that was given to the other side because they didn't need it. They had 50 people. 50. So we had 20,000 young, vibrant pro-lifers. They had 50 thin, graying ranks of just a couple dozen people on the pro-choice side of the issue. Again, we in the pro-life movement own the future. Thank you.